This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, the constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. A little later in today's program, we'll hear from Representative Chris Smith as he discusses the involvement of George Soros in the elections of countries besides America. Also, Representative Jody Heiss joins us to talk about the Johnson Amendment. But first, on Tuesday of this week, President Donald Trump announced his nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch as an Associate Justice for the Supreme Court. And now to discuss that nomination, FRC President Tony Perkins is joined by legal scholar and friend of Family Research Council, Robert George.
Robbie, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you so much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, I will tell you, as we have combed through the potential justices prior to the nominations, when I saw you early on or a few weeks back say very positive things about Judge Gorsuch, I took notice of that. Why do you think he will make a good justice?
Well, I think he was the very best possible pick. If we look at the traditional criteria for judging the fitness and excellence of potential judges, he's at the top in every category. Let's begin with quality of mind, intellect. Well, he's at the very top there. He's one of the most intelligent jurists that I certainly have ever known. I've known Judge Gorsuch now for probably about 15 years. We've had many opportunities to interact. His book, his excellent book on assisted suicide and euthanasia, was published in the book series that I edit at Princeton University Press. So I had the pleasure of working with him on that. And he's just a brilliant man. This is supported, his natural intellectual talents are supported by a first-class education. He's a graduate of Columbia University, Harvard Law School. He won both Truman and Marshall scholarships, two of the most prestigious scholarships in higher education. He went on to Oxford University, where he earned his doctorate, something very few judges have in addition to law degrees. He has a doctorate in the philosophy of law. He studied there with the very eminent philosopher of law and theorist of natural law and natural rights, John Finnis, who happened to be my own doctoral supervisor when I did my doctorate at Oxford. He published that excellent book. He's published other important scholarly writings. And then there are his opinions, which are first class. I mean, not only are they analytically deep and precise, they're lucidly written. He's one of the best writers in the federal judiciary. So we've got a superstar here intellectually. Well, what about the next set of criteria? Well, let's look at his temperament. Well, he's a level-headed person. He's a thoughtful person. He's the opposite of somebody who flies off the handle or makes rash judgments or anything like that. He carefully thinks his way through the legal issues he's confronted with and arrives at a rational judgment. Let's look at his integrity. There's not a mark against the man. He's a good father, faithful husband, generous friend, man of the highest probity, devout man. You'll be pleased, Tony, that he's going to integrate the court. He's going to bring diversity to the court because it's currently six Catholic members, or was six Catholic members until Justice Scalia died, and three Jewish members. And we'll finally have a Protestant on the court. He'll say an Episcopalian.
People don't realize that, but that is true. There has not been a Protestant member of the court.
Not for some time. Of course, there was a time when the court was mostly Protestant. There have been times when it was entirely Protestant. But we haven't had a Protestant since David Souter left the court. So that brings that element of diversity back into the picture. But, of course, the truth is that his religion doesn't matter. What matters is that he's a faithful constitutionalist. He's a textualist and an originalist. He believes that judges shouldn't be imposing their own values on the nation, but faithfully following the principles entrenched in the Constitution, enshrined in the Constitution by the founders and ratifiers. And when it comes to the interpretation of statutes, it's the will of the legislature, not the judge, that matters. The judge's role is not to make law.
Yes.
He shouldn't be doing that. When he does that, he's stealing the constitutional power of the legislative branch.
And he even,
the role of the judge is to apply it.
He included that in his remarks last night after the president presented him to the nation. He underscored that.
That's exactly right. And then we go back to the category of experience, another criterion for judging the fitness and excellence of a candidate for judicial office. Well, he finished his education. He spent a year in the Justice Department getting executive branch experience. He spent a decade in a very distinguished law firm in the private practice of law, seeing what the actual work of lawyers is, representing clients, handling cases. And now he spent the next decade, the decade after that, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit, where he's compiled a wonderful record for excellence. He's known as, here's the one respect in which he's unlike Scalia. He's very Scalia-like in many ways, Tony. He's a textualist, he's a constitutionalist, he's an originalist, he's a faithful interpreter of the law, he doesn't make the law. But here's one way in which he and Nino Scalia are quite different. Neil does not have that pugnacious, fiery Scalia personality.
Mm-hmm.
His demeanor is really quite the opposite. It's very calm, very bookish. He's a kind of scholar in the black robe. When he engages with the lawyers who appear before him in oral arguments, he doesn't try to knock them around or argue with them or intimidate them. He rather asks questions in the form of a kind of conversation that's meant to elicit answers that will enable him truly to judge the strengths and weaknesses of the arguments that they presented in the written briefs, and to give him an opportunity to raise questions about issues that he thought weren't sufficiently well-developed or addressed in the written briefs. So that's a bit of a difference, but that's really a stylistic difference.
Robbie, let me ask you this, because this has been front and center in this election. It was a major issue in determining how people voted, you know, evangelicals, Catholics, social conservatives. This was a motivating factor because they knew this vacancy existed on the court. The president, as a candidate, the first I recall of a nominee specifically stating he was going to appoint pro-life justices that were constitutionalists, that would not, you know, find things in the shadows of the Constitution. You covered that. Let me ask you this. His pro-life perspective, his pro-life views, very limited in his opinions on the life issue, but there's other writings that suggest that he has a basic fundamental understanding of the value of human life.
Well, that's certainly true. Now, it seems to me that what matters is not whether he is pro-life or not, although, Tony, you know I'm very strongly pro-life myself and have been involved in the pro-life movement as an activist since I was 13 or 14 years old. But what matters to me most fundamentally is that he's a constitutionalist.
Mm-hmm.
The constitutional ground for reversing Roe versus Wade, and it's overwhelming, the constitutional ground is that that there's no basis in the text or logic or structure or historical understanding of the Constitution for a right to abortion. This was imposed on the nation by a raw act of judicial power, to quote the dissenting justice, one of the dissenting justices in the case, Byron White. It was manufactured out of whole cloth by liberal jurists to change the laws of the nation. And Gorsuch will, I believe, I predict, vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. Not because it's an anti-life decision, though it is, but because it's a constitutional abomination. It's a usurpation of the powers of the elected representatives of the people. But as to your specific question on his views about life, there you want to go to the book that he published in my series at Princeton University Press. The book is called The Future of Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. And there he considers very carefully, thoughtfully, all the arguments that have been put forward for assisted suicide and euthanasia, and comes down against them. And he comes down against them fundamentally on the ground that human life is intrinsically valuable. We don't have our value only because of our abilities or talents or our strength or our beauty or any other extrinsic factor about us. We have our value intrinsically. It's just in virtue of being a human being. You know, people on the left often talk about how they're all for human rights. They're great human rights advocates, human rights activists. But when it comes to abortion, when it comes to euthanasia and assisted suicide, suddenly they don't believe that we have our rights in virtue of our humanity. They think we have our rights in virtue of something else, having been born or reached a certain stage of development or being cognitively functioning at a high level or being healthy and not handicapped. Gorsuch comes down in favor of the traditional Judeo-Christian principle of sanctity of human life.
Which
it's right there to read in the book.
Which in many ways is rooted in natural law.
Exactly right. And, of course, as I mentioned, he studied for his doctorate with greatest living natural law theorist, John Tennyson,
right,
of Oxford University.
I want to I quote from his book on this issue, human life is fundamental and inherently valuable, and that the intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. I mean, that's a pretty clear statement.
It's very clear. And that is what the tradition that goes back to Genesis 1 holds. Genesis 1 holds that man is made in the very image and likeness of God. And it doesn't draw distinctions. It doesn't say highly intelligent people are made in the image and likeness of God, or people who have the use of all four limbs, or people who are not suffering from dementia, or people who are already born. The principle is that each human being is fashioned in the very image and likeness of God, and therefore has his fundamental rights from a more than merely human source. They don't come from a government or a king or a parliament or a congress or a president, and therefore no merely human power can take them away.
You can find more on Judge Neil Grosich when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at how George Soros is trying to destroy democracy around the world. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
What will Donald do during his first 100 days in office? Family Research Council has laid out a conservative playbook for the president-elect to follow in order to repair some of the damage done by the Obama administration's liberal elite special interests. In a timely panel discussion, policy experts lay out a game plan of actions that the Trump administration can take in its first 100 days. Visit frc.org/first100 to view this policy discussion.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. In December, conservatives narrowly won the election in the small European nation of Macedonia. But a man familiar to us here in the U.S. is trying to disrupt democracy in Europe. Tony was joined by Representative Chris Smith on Wednesday to talk about it.
Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you so very much. Great to be on.
Well, I know you have brought attention to this. You and some of your colleagues have written a letter to the ambassador there in Macedonia about this. But I think Americans would be shocked to know that George Soros has been teaming up with the United States government through USAID and the State Department to fund leftist organizations. In fact, the old Communist Party there to try to overthrow the current conservative government.
It is outrageous that the United States would be funding an NGO, the Open Sources Open Society Foundation, Tony, that and the money is very significant. Matter of fact, there's still money in the pipeline for 2017 to 2021, $9.5 million. And, you know, we're not supposed to be taking sides. When we provide money for civic education or other similarly named programs, civil society projects, it's supposed to be about building capacity, open and free media, you know, that operates in a way that we would hope the media would operate, free and fair elections. And instead, Soros' people, and we've asked questions of Ambassador Jess Bailey, U.S. Ambassador to Macedonia, very, very significant questions, a whole slew of them, about funding an organization that then funds the ultra-left in Macedonia with an eye towards changing the laws, but also changing who gets elected. This is, you know, this is, like I said, outrageous. Under Obama, there was almost no transparency on a lot of these projects. We saw it in Kenya when, under the guise of civil society, the U.S. government paid $60 million to 81, and I actually had to get an IG investigation, because they would not tell me how much they were paying and to whom it was going, that rewrote their constitution to put a right to abortion into the constitution. And the wordsmithing from that language came from an NGO that we funded. The legislature in Kenya didn't want it, but it was done to them, not for or with them. And so now we see in Macedonia, and this is taking place, we believe, there needs to be a top-to-bottom review at the State Department to ensure that this kind of aggressive partisanship doesn't take place. I mean, It's one thing to do election monitoring, which is a very noble cause to make sure there's free and fair elections. It's quite another thing to be backing individuals and parties that that Soros and his gang want to see in control of that country. That's not what U.S. dollars should be used for. It's a total misuse by the Obama administration.
And this is not just, you know, peaceful, you know, discussions about ideological differences. This, in some cases, is funding organizations. There's a number of these organizations that got front money from Soros. Once they were set up, they got grants from USAID and other branches of the our federal government. They are inciting violence. They're rioting. They're doing a lot of what we see here in the United States right now in Washington, D.C., post-election or post-swearing-in of Donald Trump. So, I mean, this is stuff that is completely anti-democratic in what they're doing, and it's our tax dollars.
It is true, and it's also, it violates the principle that the United States foreign aid should not be promoting one candidate over another. I mean,
right.
Who are we to be telling the people of Macedonia, this is who you vote for, and then to provide money to an organization that helps them to hone a message, often in a very distorting way? You know, it should all be about how you have a civil society sector, an independent media, that ensures that citizens are well-informed, not that you're backing people who have an agenda.
I mean, this looks like
under Soros. I mean, this is a absolute outrage that our tax dollars are being misspent in this fashion. As I said, I've taken on the State Department on a number of these, especially with Kenya, and now we find out that, you know, under the radar, Soros is funding the ultra-left in Macedonia trying to topple a government.
I mean, this has all the makings of someone like a community organizer that's doing this globally.
You can find out more about Representative Chris Smith when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Marriages everywhere are in crisis. The divorce rate is sky high. What can turn things around? The key lies in what God has bestowed on mankind: incarnational attachment. This, in turn, leads to the transforming power of being emotionally present in marriage. In a profound lecture by Dr. Jesse Gill, discover more about embracing God's design for attachment for marriage and our Christian faith in ways that bring transformation and growth. Visit frc.org/events to view this lecture and many more.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. This past Thursday, FRC President Tony Perkins joined many religious and political leaders at the annual National Prayer Breakfast, where President Trump announced his intention to get rid of the Johnson Amendment, which limits religious organizations from talking about political candidates. Representative Jody Heiss was there as well, and he joined Tony on Thursday to talk about the event.
Jody, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, always great to be with you, and yes, it was an incredible a prayer breakfast this morning, and I was one of those, and I imagine you were too, when the president said mentioned his commitment to repeal the Johnson Amendment. I was on my feet with just tremendous delight. This is a major step in the right direction to religious liberties and restoring our country.
Well, I was sitting a couple tables behind Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who is your co-author in the House on the bill, watching his expression. I happened to be sitting next to the president's speechwriter, and we had a discussion about this during breakfast before the speech. And so I was very encouraged that the president did include these remarks in his speech. And I have to say, he didn't stop there. It was a pretty convincing speech, or compelling speech, I should say, about defending religious freedom.
Well, it really was, and I think more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that we are facing unprecedented times in America, and the religious liberties that we have enjoyed in our country are seriously under attack. They have been. And what a breath of fresh air it is to have a president who now speaks boldly about those things, brings them out in the forefront of the public, even willingly challenges the media when necessary, but he is committed to restoring and maintaining religious liberties in our country, without which we lose so much of our foundation as to who we are as a country. And so this is absolutely essential in so many different ways, culturally as well as politically and just with our freedoms. And so it's an enormous breath of fresh air to have a president so committed to this.
Well, one of the statements in his speech was essentially that America flourishes when religious liberty flourishes, and that was actually one of the items I was able to tweet out during the breakfast. But for the benefit of our listeners, and we've talked about it many times, but we're constantly getting new listeners on here, the Johnson Amendment. What exactly is the Johnson Amendment?
Okay, the Johnson Amendment goes back over 60 years, 1954, and LBJ comes to Washington having narrowly won a Senate race from Texas. He almost lost because a couple of nonprofits came against him because they thought he was far too soft on communism, and he almost lost that Senate race. So in, I think it's fair to say, retaliation, when he got to Washington, one of the first things he did was, behind closed doors, without any debate on the Senate floor and so forth, he had inserted into the IRS code a brief paragraph that basically says nonprofits cannot be involved in the political process or influencing the political outcomes, or they could potentially lose their tax-exempt status. So that has come to be known as the Johnson Amendment to the IRS code. And, Tony, as you well know, it has become a bully stick that has been used with great effectiveness to intimidate pastors, church leaders, various leaders of nonprofit organizations, to censor them right out of addressing cultural, political, biblical issues that happen to be in the political arena. And so we've just censored ourselves right out of the game because of fear of potential retribution from our own government. So we've got to get rid of this, and it is it's an enormous problem, and I'm confident we're going to win this.
One of the things, as you talked about, this is used to intimidate many pastors, because I cannot tell you how many pastors I've had over the years. At every election cycle, they will give me a letter that one of these atheist organizations, one of these anti-Christian organizations, sends them, telling them that if you talk about this stuff from the pulpit, you could lose your tax exemption and we'll be watching. So it's this intimidation that they use this provision of the tax code to silence these churches.
Absolutely, and I receive those letters every election cycle, and they are very intimidating. And basically they say, if you're going to address these issues, you could be sued, potentially your church could be sued, and you could potentially lose the tax-exempt status of your church. And they are very well written. They come across as though they are stating the law of the land. And it just it is a very chilling outcome that it has had on a lot of pastors. And so we have these days, as you well know, pastors all across the country simply not dealing with multiple issues, life, marriage, whatever it may be, issues that are clearly dealt with in Scripture, because they feel like to do so would be a violation of the law that could potentially cause their church to lose their tax-exempt status.
Yeah, that was the point that I made yesterday at the press conference there at the Capitol when we reintroduced this bill, was that you have pastors who, deal with moral, spiritual issues. Life, that's a moral, it's a spiritual issue. Human sexuality, the issue of marriage, those are spiritual moral issues. But what's happened is the politicians, the cultural forces have said, no, those are political issues, therefore pastors can't speak to them. And we've seen pastors back away from speaking about core moral spiritual issues. And of course, the consequences are what we see in society today.
Well, that's exactly right. And my question is, if we lose on some of those things that are so clearly biblical, what happens next? I mean, because the Bible also addresses tax issues, immigration issues, border issues. But you don't lose your First Amendment right just because you're in a church. In fact, the First Amendment protects religious speech, and obviously the core of that is in a church and obviously in the pulpit. But we all have First Amendment rights, and those rights are not taken away from us simply because we're in the church. And yet, really, that's what has been happening. And the IRS has just been infringing on our First Amendment rights for far too long, and it's an egregious attempt to take away those freedoms and ultimately destroy our constitutional rights.
Yeah, and it's the First Amendment also is the exercise, and we're going to talk about that in our next segment with Congressman Steve Russell of Oklahoma about the president and what he may or may not do in terms of protecting the ability of religious people, Christians, organizations that are religious in nature to function in society, because they're being shut down in many ways as well. Congressman Heiss, how can folks that are listening help in this effort to pass the repeal of the Johnson Amendment?
We have put forth a bill, Whip Steve Scalise and myself. It's H.R. 781. It's called the Free Speech Fairness Act, and it basically just makes it very clear that if a pastor or any ministry leader or what have you of a nonprofit organization is just going about their regular business and activities of their ministry, that they can address political issues without fear of intimidation or retaliation from our government. So that's basically what the Free Speech Fairness Act does. What we need is twofold at this point, Tony. Number one, we need prayer support, as this is obviously getting some negative press, and particularly from those who want to silence Christians, this is going to continue to face some opposition from that direction. But beyond the prayer support, we need people to call their representatives, both Congress in the House and the Senate, and encourage them to get involved with the Free Speech Fairness Act. Senator Langford from Oklahoma has joined a similar bill in the Senate. So this is moving in both chambers, and we just need people to contact their representatives and urge them to get on board.
All right. Well, we will absolutely do that. And Congressman Heiss, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for leading out on such an important piece of legislation.
Well, Tony, it's an honor and always a joy to be with you on here. Thank you for all you do.
If you missed any of today's program, you can find a link to it by heading over to tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.